This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Today's program was recorded before a live audience at the University of South Carolina, and the conversation series is sponsored by the University of South Carolina's College of Arts and Sciences and Institute for Southern Studies. Welcome. The overall theme of the four conversations we're going to have is South Carolina and the New Nation. Now, most people think of this period of American history, politics, politics, politics. But in this instance, South Carolina, as it has been through much of her history, is a little bit different. It's all about the economy. The economy in this period from the Revolution to 1819 shaped and had an impact on the state's population, its politics, and its religion. And the other conversations next week, for example, Professor Larry Watson of South Carolina State is going to talk about how all this had an impact on the population of South Carolina. And then Dean Ford will be back for number three to talk about religion. And then we will end up with politics with Professor Brent Morris of USC Buford. Now, tonight's guest, Dr. Peter Kirklinis, Chapel Hill, the other Carolina. He's been chair of the Department of History there. He currently is the Albert Ray Newsom Distinguished Professor, director of their Global Research Institute, and his publications have dealt with the American South, past and present. And so, Peter, welcome back. Let's just kind of set the background. We want to deal with the post-revolutionary period, but let's go back a little bit earlier, like to 1763, and kind of set the ground rules for South Carolina's economy for folks out there. What was going on and the things that helped make Carolina the richest colony in British North America?
That's a good question. I think one could argue that in the colonial period, there were really two Carolinas. There was the South Carolina Low Country, you know, the area, the eastern third of the current state, which was very much integrated into world markets already and produced lots of both rice and indigo for international markets using enslaved African American laborers primarily, but was very well integrated into global networks. And as Walter pointed out, that area was by far the richest part of British North America. In fact, it was several times wealthier on a per capita basis than the next wealthiest part of British North America, which was Anne Arundel County in Maryland. So it was extremely wealthy. The backcountry, however, that is to say the area, what we now call the Intercoastal Plain and the Piedmont, was in a much more rudimentary state, I think it's fair to say, in the pre-revolutionary period. It was far away from markets, transport, and communications was a difficult thing, especially trying to get goods to Charleston or one of the market outlets. It was populated largely by small yeoman farmers. The population was much smaller. About the time of the Revolution, it was about 30,000. Only about 6,000, I think, were African American, enslaved African Americans. So it was a very different population profile. What was happening in the period, though, is that there was not, in my view at least, a reluctance or antipathy to engage in commercial exchange. It was just that there was not yet a viable commercial option out there. And transport and communications facilities were non-existent, or the costs of getting goods to the market were prohibitive. And this meant that most people lived relatively close to subsistence in relatively rudimentary form. It was a very much a frontier area, but the people there were, I think, energetic, often entrepreneurial, and looking around for possibilities of transforming their material living standards in ways that would have positive long-term impact.
In terms of trade, for example, about the only real town in the backcountry, if you go just from the Carolinas all the way to Virginia, was Camden.
Yeah.
But Peter's right, they're two different economies, and it's hard to overestimate the wealth and the influence of Charleston and the Low Country. If you lived in the southern colonies in 1770, for example, if you lived in North Carolina, your goods came through Charleston and then were transported to Wilmington and New Bern and places like that. If you wanted a real newspaper, you subscribed to the South Carolina Gazette, which had not only subscription agents in every parish in South Carolina, but in North Carolina, Savannah, St. Augustine, Pensacola, Mobile, all of the British Southeast. The late George Rogers used to refer to Charleston as a city-state, much like Venice. The Indian trade, which we don't even mention much anymore, the deerskins, South Carolina controlled that all the way to the Mississippi River. And we're talking about literally tens of thousands of deerskins being exported annually. Rice was imported. Peter mentioned indigo. But even at the time of the Revolution, the export of meat products, pork and beef, was about 10 or 12% of the exports. Deerskins were about 10 or 12%. And South Carolina, mostly because of the farmers in the Orangeburg area, were exporting wheat and flour at the American Revolution. So you do have your big money crops, rice and indigo, and believe me, both of them were major money crops, but you've got other ways that people made money. So it was never a monoculture as in the West Indies. The folks in South Carolina, they took advantage of something. If it worked, if it didn't, they abandoned it.
The backcountry farmers, as Walter pointed out, did a lot of foodstuff exporting in the late colonial period. And much of this actually went to the Caribbean, which, as Walter pointed out, was most of the islands there were monocultures of one type, generally sugar, but sometimes, in some cases, tobacco. And it made more sense for the West Indian colonies to specialize in the crop where they had a comparative advantage and to buy their foodstuffs from South Carolina or North Carolina, and some cases even from the middle colonies, places like Delaware, southeastern Pennsylvania, South Jersey, areas like that. But it was extremely difficult the further back you went into the what we would call the Piedmont of South Carolina to try to get goods to market. There are a number of studies that show that it often cost as much to get a wagon load of goods from the backcountry of South Carolina to Charleston as it did to ship goods all the way to London or Liverpool across the Atlantic Ocean at 3,000 miles away, just because, especially if you had to go overland, because the roads were often impassable or if not impossible.
The development of rice as a major staple crop, people think it was there from 1670, but that's not exactly the case.
No, in the early period, it's kind of interesting. I know we're going to get to cotton at one point, but in 1670, when the first permanent settlement of Europeans and Africans in what is now South Carolina got going, people were casting about for something to make a commercial go of it in addition to subsistence crops. So some people have labeled this process one of bioprospecting. People tried a lot of different crops back then, whether it's silk or ginger or cotton, rice, tobacco, anything, but there was not really a rice economy in South Carolina to speak of really until the 18th century, when there was a big shift and transition in South Carolina low country from a rudimentary pioneer stage of development of lots of different crops, trading with Indians, deerskins, piracy, anything to try to find a commercial vehicle in order to kind of entrench themselves, to developing sufficient knowledge and capital to create a platform to produce rice as an industry. That is to say, in a commercially viable way, systematically and regularly enough to find their way into the markets in Northern Europe, which were the main markets. But this was a time-intensive process that took a lot of time. It's not easy to grow rice. A lot of knowledge had to be built up. You had to get a labor force. You had to transform the environment in such a way as to enable rice to be grown with sufficient water supplies and control of water in order to make a go of it. And there were alternative sources of supply. So if you weren't efficient enough to sell rice in the leading markets at a competitive price, those markets could get their rice from northwestern Italy, northeastern Brazil, from Portugal, from Spain. There were lots of alternatives, and it took a considerable amount of entrepreneurship on the part of early South Carolina planters to find their way in this world. And certainly, I'm sure we'll get to this, but by the third decade of the 18th century, they had done this. And by the middle of the 18th century, they became the Western world's leading supplier of rice. And this is largely what helped create the mass wealth of the South Carolina Lowcountry.
Peter, I loved your description of bioprospecting.
Yeah.
The first governor sent out here actually was given a list of things to try, set up an agricultural experimental station. You know, you mentioned crops that they experimented with. They tried cotton. It didn't work. Ginger. And then even later on, people tried things like pistachios, olives, grapes, mahogany trees. None of these things worked. And the deerskin trade, which we mentioned, was not actually the first big thing. The first big thing was cattle ranching, food products. Deerskins were always there, but then it was naval stores, pine, pitch, tar, turpentine. South Carolina has always benefited, at least while in the empire, from government subsidies. The British government paid a bounty. The Royal Navy needed good source of tar, turpentine, pitch for the ships. And most of that was coming from Sweden, which may or may not be a friend to England. And so they found out they could be taken care of in the colonies. But if you read the history of the naval stores industry in the United States, it's all about New England, but South Carolina actually produced about 80% of the naval stores that were shipped to England. And they continued to do so until the bounty was stopped. And that was in the 1720s, and it is about that time, the late 1720s, that rice picked up. Without the bounty, South Carolina's naval stores couldn't compete with other places. Rice, as Peter said, really took off. And it took off not in the way we think about it. We go to the Lowcountry today, and you see what's left of the rice fields, those huge expanses along the Santee, down along the Edisto. In most of the pre-revolutionary period, rice was grown in inland swamps.
Much further inland than the tidal river zone where rice ultimately was positioned and ensconced, beginning in the late 1750s, or maybe a little earlier, but certainly in the last couple of decades of the late 18th century is when the shift to what we would now call the tidal zone and most of the remnants of the rice era in South Carolina are visible today. The inland swamps were generally smaller places that could provide the kind of water control necessary for irrigated rice. And irrigated rice doesn't just mean getting water on, but also a place to get water off the rice fields when you wanted it off. So it would be basically impounding a little pond and through relatively rudimentary water control, getting some water onto the field when you needed it during certain stages in the growing season, and then finding a way through the creation of a sluice to get off when you wanted it off the rice for proper growing. And this form of production actually continued in the 19th century, although it was a far cry from its importance in the first half of the 18th century. And interestingly enough, African Americans, well after slavery ended, continued to grow rice in this way in the area of what we would now call the intercoastal plain and the outer coastal plain, actually, until the 1930s in some cases. So it was kind of interesting because they had been involved early on in the production technology and understood the way to both grow rice and to control water. And on small garden plots and in little impoundments, they continued to grow rice till much later. Actually, even at the time of the Civil War, there were inland swamps as far as Columbia, really. People were still growing rice in this inland fashion, not so much for commercial production because it was not nearly as efficient as the great tidal plantations in the Lowcountry, but it often helped very much for a domestic food supply. You could also feed a lot of the domestic populations in South Carolina with inland swamp rice.
Yep. Down along the Watery River, if you go the Sumter Highway and cross the Watery, that area they were growing rice up to the Civil War, but it was primarily for local consumption.
Right.
Let's move on to the Hayward brothers, if you will, who really were the pioneers of the tidal cultivation of rice. First, remember, all of that construction was done by hand, a pick and a shovel. The land had to be cleared as well. And you're talking taking down virgin cypress, tupelo, what have you, with a crosscut saw and an axe. All of this is not just labor intensive, it's capital intensive. It was expensive to go into rice production. The average rice dike was 12 to 15 feet wide at its base, usually about 5 feet high and 3 feet across at the top. And of course, you know many of the rice, crossing the rice dikes, those were used for transportation. Mm-hmm. Now, you had some real exceptions. Samuel Porcher on the Santee in 1817 began creating what would become one of the largest impoundment areas in South Carolina. He didn't finish his plan until 1841, outside our time period. But I think the statistics are incredible. 4.5 miles of dikes, all built by hand, enclosed 1,400 acres of rice fields. At the base, because of the flow of the Santee, he needed larger dikes. His rice dikes were 30 to 60 feet across at the base and 8 to 14 feet high. Now again, all of this is produced by hand labor. And the capital investment in that labor, if you were building a rice dike, you weren't producing a crop for sale.
Yeah, it was tremendously capital intensive and labor intensive, and it was a year-round work. This stuff, these rice works required constant maintenance, not only because of weather events, but just because of the sliding mud and water flows, and you're constantly bringing water in and out, often at because of the tides at a pretty large amount of force, and this leads to lots of erosion. One of the more interesting things about the labor demands, and this the best evidence for this comes a little bit later, but almost all of the original construction work was done by enslaved African Americans. But in a little bit after the period we're talking about, in the 1840s and 50s, most of the upkeep in many of these places was done by Irish immigrants because the enslaved African Americans were considered too valuable. The work itself was very, very onerous, and a lot of the upkeep was done after the harvest, and so it's in the winter, and you're in a cold ditch in the low country in December, January, February, and by that time, enslaved African Americans were going for a lot of money, and a prudent planter would say, I can get an Irish worker to do this, and if that person dies, who cares, basically. If it's my capitalized labor gets sick or dies, then it's a real capital loss on my accounting sheets, on my balance sheet. So often you find these Irish workers coming down and doing this rice work in the winter, which was terribly difficult and hard work. And I think it goes to show some of the possibilities and limitations for many workers in America who were coming as immigrant workers in the 19th century, as well as what we see today with immigrant work.
Yeah. So it wasn't until pre-revolutionary years that it began to be a real industry, Peter.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when it did, it really took off because there was a great demand in Europe at that particular point in time for rice. Now, rice is not a commodity like sugar or tobacco, which there aren't many substitutes for. If you want something sweet in the 18th century, you don't have artificial sweeteners, you use honey or sugar. And if you want nicotine, you use tobacco. But rice in the West, in the Western world, is not like rice in Asia. You know, we don't pray for our daily rice in the West. For the most part, you pray for your daily bread. So what rice is in the Western world is largely a versatile dietary complement or supplement that is used to feed people if the price of wheat or barley or rye got too expensive or was in short supply because of a harvest failure. It was also used as an animal feed and as an industrial crop. You made a lot of starch out of rice or paste or things like that. But the thing about rice is that it didn't have the monopolistic position in the market as a sugar did or tobacco. If rice got too expensive, they'd say, okay, I'll try barley or something else. And this was something that ultimately came back to haunt, I would argue, the South Carolina, because it didn't have this position in the marketplace. There were too many substitutes. The rice in the Western world, that in Northern Europe in particular, was often bought or used to feed the masses, relatively poor groups or people in the army, in the navy, in schools, in orphanages, inmates in prisons, people on the dole. It was often handed out in that way. Today, it's very different. Rice is what economists call an income elastic crop. That is to say, the higher your income, the more rice you eat. But in those days, it was largely used to feed poor people. But the population was growing very rapidly in Europe in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Industrialization was taking place, urbanization was taking place, and there was a great need for food, particularly complex carbohydrates like rice that give you a lot of calories. If you were working in a factory and you needed to get the biggest bang for the buck, often, you know, rice would kind of fill you up. And so there was a big demand for rice, and South Carolina for a period of time was the most efficient and the best producer of rice for the Western world. Of course, South Carolina produced some great rice, as we know, and we, you know, you've all heard about Carolina Gold and white rice first. And at the high end of the market, that would be very appealing. But the problem was, and I think South Carolinians later found this out, is that at the end of the day, rice became a commodity too kind of quickly, where price was the thing that mattered rather than quality. And while most everyone admitted the quality of Carolina rice, the market danced to the price. And later on, as we'll see, cheaper rice was made available in the market. And if you're feeding hogs with rice, as they did in southern Germany, Germans like their pork, you didn't care if it was Carolina Gold or something from Bengal or Burma or Siam or Vietnam or wherever. You just wanted something cheap. And so South Carolina, in some ways, was penalized by the quality of the rice, which was harder to grow and also more expensive because, contrary to what many people believe, slave labor was not cheap. Slaves were quite expensive, and there was a premium on production in South Carolina. And if you look at the differential prices in Europe of rice after about the 1830s, South Carolina rice was always much higher priced. And so for some consumers, they were willing to pay the premium, but many others were not.
Peter, in Shadow of a Dream, you used the term that the golden age of rice ended about 1820, which is about the end of the time period that we're talking about, South Carolina, the new nation. You want to go into why you think that?
Yeah, I think what was happening, I think, is that for the period between the middle of the 18th century and the early 19th century, 1820, 1830, somewhere around then, South Carolina was in a privileged position in the Western market for rice. What happens, however, in the late 18th century and the early 19th century is gradually the European imperial states begin to expand outward and get into Asia more and more readily. And there are a series of transportation and communications improvements in the 19th century having to do with the organization of shipping. Once peace breaks out, as it were, in 1815, you know, any longer have to have as many guns on the ships, insurance rates fall, and it becomes much more feasible to get rice from other parts of the world. And this increasingly happens as British penetration, in particular, into eastern India, into what is now Bengal, which was a kind of one of the centers of the world rice belt, develops. And gradually, from the 1820s on, it becomes possible for cheaper Asian rice to get into Europe. And because of the market, the nature of the market for rice, which is responding more and more to cheapness rather than quality, over time, rice first from Bengal, a little bit later from Java in what is now Indonesia, then from Burma, Siam, Thailand, and what was then known as Cochin China or South Vietnam, began to outcompete rice at the bottom end of the market in Europe. And gradually, you see South Carolina's ability to export to the key markets declining. South Carolina exports of rice, and most of the rice produced in the Lowcountry was always exported, actually were lower in 1850s than they had been in the 1790s. And what happens beginning in the 20s and then gradually over the rest of what we call the antebellum period before the Civil War is that rice exported from South Carolina begins to be sent to the lesser markets, particularly to the Caribbean. And it's used, ironically, to feed slaves on the late developing sugar colonies of Cuba, which becomes the great middle of the 19th century sugar exporter, and Puerto Rico. And so it's quite interesting. We lose our ability, South Carolina loses its ability to export to the greatest markets, but the planters and merchants and factors are still entrepreneurial enough to shift the market to the Caribbean. Much of the decline of the Lowcountry after the heyday is relative in nature. It's not by any means that these planters were becoming impoverished or anything like that, but their relative degree of dominance and their relative degree by which they outpaced the rest of North Americans in terms of wealth and income began to be reduced at that period. And it became particularly apparent once places in the North began to industrialize.
Just one of those ironies of history. You may remember from previous years we talked about nullification, what have you. One of the complaints about South Carolina was the tariff. Well, in the 1840s, because of the competition from Burmese rice in particular, South Carolina's anti-tariff delegation got the federal government to put on a tariff on imported rice to protect the price of South Carolina rice. Until that happened, you could actually buy Burmese rice at the Charleston market cheaper than you could buy rice grown in Georgetown County. But let's move on now to the Revolution. Indigo continues briefly after the Revolution. Again, it had been supported by a bounty, but that wasn't what did it in. It was quality,
yeah.
The lack of quality. In the 1790s, after the Revolution, South Carolina planters still grew indigo, but by 1795, it had disappeared as a commercial crop, replaced by cotton. And now we're going to get into, I think, the crop that really helped change South Carolina's history and shape religion, politics, and population for the next 60 years.
As much as I don't like to admit it, I work on rice, but the big enchilada, as it were, in Southern history is, in fact, as you all know, cotton. That's probably what brought most of you here, and certainly in South Carolina's antebellum history, or really from the early 19th century on, cotton informs and shapes and dominates South Carolina's economic history and that of much of the South. Now, the South really has five leading commercial staples in the 19th century, and there's rice, my little part of the world, and there's tobacco, and there's sugar, and there's hemp, which was used for sailcloth and rope rather than as a recreational drug in that period, and cotton. And cotton is by far the most important in most of the South, although not all of the South. And As Walter alluded to, there were attempts very early on to play around and bioprospect with cotton, but it's really not, and I think Walter will probably want to introduce this, until the late 18th century when cotton begins to take hold, and rapidly it becomes the mainstay of not only of South Carolina, but the rest of the South until the 1950s.
The first major attempt at cotton in South Carolina actually occurred during the Revolution, 1780. Kinsey Burden, down in the Lowcountry, began to grow Sea Island cotton. Now, to understand cotton, there are two kinds of cotton. There's Sea Island cotton and there's upland cotton. And Sea Island cotton, the name is true, you can't grow it very far from the coast. It spread after the Revolution of as far as the Santee, but it was Eli Whitney down in Georgia coming up with the cotton gin that really changed the picture. And this is, again, this is a statistic, and this is something that Peter and Lacey Ford have done some work on. In 1794, South Carolina exported 94,000 pounds of cotton. That's not a lot of cotton. Almost all of it was Sea Island cotton. 6 years later, in 1800, South Carolina exported 20 million pounds, almost all of it upcountry cotton. And it all has to do with economy, labor, and the product. Upland cotton, green seed cotton, those seeds stick to the lint. The fiber's short. And to do it by hand, it doesn't produce anything worth marketing. But you put a commercial gin in there and you separate the fiber or the lint from those seeds, and all of a sudden, you've got something that you can mass produce. And you've got this first cotton boom. It comes in South Carolina, begins about 1794, and it lasts until about 1819 with the economic collapse in the United States. So I'll let you take it a little bit from there.
Well, you know, that's a really good intro, and hopefully the segue will work. But as Walter pointed out, there was a big movement, as you can imagine, in any war to try to make do without imports. And so South Carolinians began, there was a kind of homespun kind of movement in South Carolina during the Revolution. People started to kind of make more of their own clothing, and whether they made it out of flax linen or sometimes wool, but cotton began to be grown in a little bit more for domestic use. It wasn't done efficiently, certainly. It wasn't done in export quality or quantity right away, but we began at that period. It was, as Walter pointed out, there was some in the backcountry, but it was mostly Sea Island Gossypium B, it's called, generally growing out of the, originating in the Caribbean. I think most people think the earliest stuff came from the Bahamas, I guess, to South Carolina. It has a very long staple, over 1 1/4 inches, so it's very high quality. The long staple, or Sea Island cotton, however, is pretty low yielding. It's hard to grow, and it's very labor intensive. Short staple cotton has some advantages, as Walter alluded to, that make it the preferred species of cotton that really takes over the South in the 19th century. It's also high quality, although it has a shorter staple. It's easier to grow. It can grow over a much greater range of different types of climates than the Sea Island cotton. It's more resistant to disease. And as time passes, and this is one of the things that's really crucial in trying to understand how and why Southern cotton became the world's preferred cotton, is that the growers in the South, very entrepreneurial, did what we would now call scientific plant breeding pretty early on. By the first decade of the 19th century, they were developing types of seeds largely taken from Mexico and then bred for the various soils of the South that made it propitious to and favorable for the machinery that was developing in England and in the continent of Europe during the Industrial Revolution, the textile machinery. As Walter pointed out, you needed somehow to separate the seed from the lint, essentially. And this was very difficult early on, particularly with the relatively rudimentary types of ginning equipment, these roller gins early on. Eli Whitney developed basically in a kind of primitive form early on, a sawtooth gin, which was able to really rip this kind of lint out of the seed and made it much easier and cost effective to market. Now, one thing that's quite interesting is that while we focus a lot on Whitney, there were cotton gins for 1,000 years prior to Whitney in mainly in India and China, including some sawtooth gins, but they were pretty much unknown in the West. And there was, in many technological innovations, there are often different people developing a technology at around the same time, independently of one another. So it's not that Whitney was copying anyone. He developed this himself, and it became very, very important. The revolution that Walter alluded to with these stunning statistics about the growth happened because of changes in what economists would call the demand side. There was a great demand for cotton because of this industrial revolution that made it possible to produce massive amounts of textiles in a centralized factory with enhanced power sources, steam. And that generated a big demand for cotton, but without the supply response, that is to say, people in South Carolina and a little bit later in East Central Georgia, creating a platform in which they could put together production of sufficient quality and quantity and regularity and get it to across the ocean, first to England, and then although a lot ultimately went to the continent of Europe and later on to New England and the Middle Atlantic states, unless they were able to do that, they weren't going to be able to take advantage of the opportunities. So when opportunity knocked, very entrepreneurial populations in South Carolina responded. One of the things that's, let me put in a plug for, there's a new book out that came out this fall, which is a Festschrift, that is to say a scholarly book by a bunch of eminent scholars in the South dedicated to Walter for his contributions to Southern history and South Carolina history. And I wrote a piece on inventive activity in South Carolina. And I tried to make the case that, you know, there had been an argument that South Carolina and the rest of the South was not very interested in technological change or invention or innovation, and they were kind of not anywhere near as sophisticated and innovative as in the North. And I tried to say that's not really true. They looked a lot like other rural states. But one of the things that would have made South Carolina and the rest of the South look much, much better is if patenting could have been done on crops. Seeds and varieties, but this wasn't possible in the United States until 1930. So if those had been added to the patenting activity of South Carolina in the first half of the 19th century, there would have been a huge spike in inventive activity. Most of the inventive activity in entrepreneurship and capital and labor, and 80% of South Carolina slaves were involved in cotton. Much of it was involved in agriculture and in improving agriculture. And Walter pointed out this amazing just surge of production. Right after the War of 1812, when prices were very high for cotton until the middle of the 1820s, and then they were down for a long time because of this surge of supply. But in terms of bales in 1815, the South produced about 150,000 bales of cotton. By the time of the Civil War, it was 4.5 million bales, and bales got bigger and bigger. Lacey, what were they, about 500 pounds by the time of the Civil War, as opposed to a couple hundred in the early 19th century? So there was this 30-fold increase over the course of this period, this massive, impressive response. And not only did it begin in South Carolina and then spread to East Central Georgia, but by the late antebellum period, it's all the way into Eastern Texas and all over the rest of the South, reshaping the whole Southern part of the United States. And if you believe some scholars, and I think they're probably right, the whole American economy.
Well, I mentioned Eli Whitney, and South Carolina actually paid him, not till 1802, paid him $50,000, about $1 million in today's money, so that anybody in South Carolina could take the plans for his gin and make them. But somebody was doing something similar to Whitney before that, because by 1795, Wade Hampton was already becoming the greatest cotton planter in the country, and he may or may not have had a Whitney gin, but it wasn't alone. I could have carried those statistics from 94,000 pounds to 20 million in 1800. By 1810, it was 50 million pounds.
These planters and yeoman farmers, remember early on, the cotton wasn't necessarily produced always very efficiently early on, and it was often smaller people in the first instance, but then once opportunities were available, those with access to capital began to create larger units of production with more labor and more systematic routine that would allow them to grow massive amounts of cotton for these markets. And they were responding to this great demand, and prices between the early 19th century, well, really until the early 1820s, except for a few years, were always high. And then, basically, despite the great expansion, you couldn't catch demand right away. But then, as the rest of the South began to basically replicate the South Carolina model and begin to try to create a plantation world of cotton throughout the rest of the South, we begin to see supply catching up to demand. And really, for most of the period between the mid-1820s and about 1855, prices were pretty low for cotton, beneath 10 cents a pound, except for a little bit in middle of the 1830s, 1834 to 1836. And this was in part because of this massive entrepreneurial surge of cotton planters throughout the rest of the South. Now, it's not always a pretty picture. You cleared Native Americans off of much of this area in what we would now call the lower Mississippi Valley. A good part of the production was done with enslaved labor. But looking at it as an economic problem that was being solved, this was an amazing entrepreneurial feat. People who study migration are stunned by the degree to which the South was filled up far faster than immigrants moved west in the North. Now, there was compulsion involved, certainly. You can get slave labor to move to Louisiana or to Mississippi easier than maybe an Irish or a German worker who would arrive in New York and say, well, I think my prospects are better in Minnesota or Indiana or somewhere, and gradually move there. But from an economic viewpoint, it is a stunningly effective and efficient market response. One of the interesting things, and just kind of ironies, is that while South Carolina in 1820 produces more than half of the cotton produced in the United States, it goes down to about 6%, 7% by 1860, despite the fact that it's producing a huge amount more than it had in 1820. It's just that the rest of the South is beginning to grow more and more cotton. And similarly, while it seems in a sense that there's a quote-unquote relative decline in South Carolina and in the cotton economy, what is happening is many of the entrepreneurs in South Carolina are either sending their money or family members or themselves out to the old Southwest into these new cotton lands, which are fresh cotton lands, growing this Mexican seed cotton, which grows better out in the further west you are, and making heaps of money in places like Adams County, Mississippi, or in Alabama, or Natchez area, or Tensaw County in Louisiana. And there's like a diaspora of South Carolina planters, planter culture, and South Carolina capital out west. So it's really melding together a whole regional economy. So what looks at one end, you know, like South Carolina might be losing market share, in another sense, South Carolina is everywhere in the first half of the 19th century in building the southern economy.
People focus a lot on the plantation aspect, yet even in South Carolina, way beyond the period we're talking about, up to the Civil War, 15 or 20% of the farmers in the upcountry were tenant farmers, yeoman farmers. And this is where capitalization and comparing this to rice makes a big difference. You had to have a lot of capital to invest in a major rice plantation, particularly the way the Hayward brothers and Samuel Pershay were doing it. But with cotton, the land was not particularly an issue. You could still get land grants in South Carolina. The seed, rudimentary farm tools, and then the labor force, whether you may have one slave, or in most cases, you've got your family. And you can, you don't have to have a gin yourself, because one of the things that developed very quickly in the country crossroads in South Carolina was somebody built a cotton gin. It was a way for people to move up in the world, certainly through 1819, 1820, somewhere along in there. Now, comparison of dollars is always a tricky thing. Historians, economic historians, there are various measures you can do. So just take that in mind. But in 1818, which is almost the end of the period we're talking about, the price of cotton in 1818 was almost 31 cents a pound. In today's dollars, that's $5.69 a pound. Do you know what the price of cotton was today in South Carolina? 73 cents a pound.
Cotton allowed small people and farmers to make a go of it. And you see this, you know, much later, while small white yeoman farmers without any slaves were always involved in cotton production, they began marketing more of their production in the late antebellum period. And then after the Civil War, when slavery was over, cotton production continued to rise in South Carolina. It doesn't, I think it peaks in 1911. And in the United States as a whole, cotton production peaks in 1927. You know, there's James Henry Hammond's "Cotton is King" kind of statement in 1857. And in a sense, cotton is kind of the prince in the antebellum period. It becomes king after the Civil War when it becomes much greater and the South becomes even more tethered to cotton later on than it was in the antebellum period, despite the massive growth of the cotton economy.
Again, small farmers could do cotton. You couldn't be a small rice planter. To jump ahead to comparing rice country and cotton country, in statistics that Peter and Lacey Ford have done comparing per capita wealth in South Carolina in 1860, everybody automatically says, oh, Georgetown County must have been the richest county in the state. No. Sumter. Sumter County was the wealthiest, either per capita or free per capita. And so you put Sumter County in 1860, not just the richest county in South Carolina, but way up there in terms of above the national average in the United States. And it's all because of cotton.
Yeah, people who have studied the economics of agriculture in the 19th century, especially two economists, a guy named Paul Rohde and Alan Olmsted, have recently written that if you look at the degree of innovation in cotton production in the 19th century, it is much greater than what was done in wheat. And everyone knows about Cyrus Hall McCormick, who is a Southerner, by the way, although most of his acclaim came in first in Cincinnati and then in Chicago. There were the private equivalents in the antebellum period of state experiment stations, essentially. And there were, as Walter knows, every county or parish had an agricultural society that promoted better practices and better seeds and better marketing and better transportation. And the South Carolina Agricultural Society was one of the most formidable in the country. So in terms of agriculture in the 19th century, South Carolina is really one of the keys really to understanding what goes on really for the entire century. Summing up, I would say that if one looks at the cotton South in the 19th century, it's a kind of difficult conversation in some ways, obviously, prior to the Civil War, because enslaved labor is involved in the production, certainly in rice, but in the other crops as well. But one has to also remember that we are living 150, 160 years after the end of slavery in the American South. And it's very easy to have what the historian E.P. Thompson have called the enormous condescension of posterity and looking back at people who lived before us. And I think that one has to put Southern agriculture, cotton production, the expansion of the South in the period in which it operated. And in an entrepreneurial sense, in an economic sense, in an agricultural sense, people who are interested in economic development can learn much from the way in which South Carolinians and Georgians and Alabamians and others responded to economic opportunity and tried to solve the challenges before them.
We're going to stop there. And Peter, I want to thank you for coming back to be with us tonight. And folks, next week we'll be talking about the impact of cotton and agriculture on the population and changing demography of South Carolina. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. Peter Kirklonis is a longtime friend, also a longtime laborer in the field of Southern history and particularly South Carolina history. And during the discussion, I think we found out how complicated the story of cotton was and its impact on various aspects of the Palmetto State. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of the Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.